Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. Today's quick read is from Sarah Jamie Lewis, and you can find her on Twitter. I think that's actually her tag, is her just full name, at Sarah Jamie Lewis. Let's check real here just to make sure. Yeah, Sarah Jamie Lewis, that's right. She's been a lot of buzz around her, and I've been really enjoying her tweets and all the stuff that's going on Twitter, because she has been doing a lot of writing and a lot of posting about some major issues that the IOTA network has been having. And because of that, she's getting both a lot of praise and, of course, a whole lot of flack for doing so. I have really enjoyed her tweets and stuff, so I've started reading some of the work she's done. And I thought this one was really good and applicable very broadly to all of these consensus mechanisms and just kind of the adversarial mindset in designing these networks from the beginning. So we will hit one that is on her page, which is fieldnotes.resistant.tech. And this is titled Adversaries, Distributed Ledgers, and Decentralization. So we'll hit a little bit of commentary afterward, but let's go ahead and jump in. A number of alternative structures for distributed ledgers have been proposed in recent years. All of those solutions offer better decentralization, faster and more numerous transactions, serving a larger number of nodes. I have been skeptical of such systems for a long time. Given an adversarial environment, I don't believe you can maintain secure, decentralized consensus and have timely confirmation between arbitrary parties and scale up to large number of nodes and transactions. Each word in that statement is very important. We can easily throw away decentralization to scale up processing and transaction rate. However, considering that one of the core motivations of distributed ledgers is to remove trusted third parties, I don't see wide adoption of such systems appealing. As such, I will limit my discussion to decentralized consensus. There is an inherent trade-off when decentralizing. The more nodes or transactions, and the more processing and communication between nodes, the longer it takes for an arbitrary party to be aware of the global state. In order to have secure transactions between parties, each party must be aware of the global state of the network. We can easily throw away security and have really fast transactions, but our system would be worthless. Proof-of-work blockchains solve this security of global state problem through mining, or rather through the computational power required to produce valid blocks. An adversary can't double spend without investing considerable resources to acquire the computational power required to produce valid blocks faster than the rest of the network. The trade-off that proof-of-work blockchains make for this secure decentralization is necessarily against scalability. Mining blocks is computationally expensive and takes time. The transactions per second is therefore tightly bound to the size of the produced blocks and the rate at which they are produced. An alternative system must provide a mechanism for achieving a secure global state, and further, they must do so in a way that is more efficient than a proof-of-work blockchain. And there we hit the crux of my issue with the new generation of distributed ledger structures. They all fundamentally fail to achieve the above. It isn't that many of these systems aren't mathematically sound, they are. The issue is that the adversarial models presented by these systems are incompatible with real-world networks. Without questions, they require us to make one or more of the following assumptions. All peers have a timely, complete, and uncompromised view of the network, or all peers, an honest total majority or a partial but delegated majority, are online and reachable at all times. Again, all of those words are important. A timely and complete view of a network is a very hard task in an adversarial network. Adversaries may partition the network. Transactions may get dropped by relay nodes. Undersea cables get cut, etc. In proof-of-work blockchain systems, any peer is able to estimate how complete their view of the network is at any given time. Further, peers will only accept blocks in order and with expected difficulty. That mechanism is missing in many proposals. Without the convergence provided by a difficult-to-construct block, peers have no way of establishing trust in the transactions or other messages they are receiving. Implementing, quote, trusted witnesses solves that problem. Trusted witnesses are nodes that are known to have greater connectivity or are otherwise trusted to maintain the canonical global state. While it is conjecture, I believe that any mechanism to, quote, decentralize such a witness will rapidly resemble a blockchain. Vote-driven consensus, where peers directly or indirectly vote, weighted by their stake in the system, on new blocks, can be seen as a special case of, quote, trusted witnesses, albeit one with a sound economic argument. Peers with a greater stake in the system are unlikely to harm it. Otherwise, they would harm their own interests. There are arguments to be made about the relative centralization of proof-of-work versus stake distribution that I won't go into. I instead want to address my core complaint of such constructions: availability. To ensure that transactions are confirmed in a timely manner, voting must also happen in a timely manner. In order for voting to be secure, all parties with stake in the system must vote. Or some statistically random sample of parties must vote, or some delegated representatives of parties must vote in every round. This requires active participation in the system. Peers must be online, and a significant amount of cross-communication. Every party must receive and verify every other party's vote. If a party with a large stake in the system drops offline, the system either grinds to a halt or the stake required to produce an adversarial block decreases substantially. It does not seem practical for systems to require that all parties remain online indefinitely. Delegated voting systems trend towards centralization and are difficult to reconcile with a large user base who may be uninterested in how the system operates. As such, they are likely vulnerable to vote buying and other electoral rigging. I hope that I am wrong. Maybe there is a way to provide secure, decentralized consensus and have timely confirmation between arbitrary parties and scale up to a large number of nodes and transactions. However, there is no system today which can promise all three, despite an epidemic of systems making such promises. So that was a really great one from Sarah Jamie Lewis, which you can find that one at fieldnotes.resistant.tech. And she's got a couple other ones posted. They've been coming pretty quick here. That was the first one she posted on July 8th, but now she's hit one on July 10th and the 12th as well today. And I'm actually about to read the one on privacy and peer-to-peer protocols. She does post a lot about privacy and stuff on Twitter, and in addition, she's been source of a whole lot of fun and drama and reading about IOTA in recent weeks on her Twitter page, and I won't spoil the fun there. Definitely go check her out, and that's at Sarah Jamie Lewis, SarahJamieLewis, on Twitter. So, of course, I'll tag her and link to the website as well. But I thought this article was particularly good at just kind of hitting the fundamental element that the security of all of these things is strictly in how well they deal with adversarial conditions. any system, network, or social hierarchy, a system of authority, they'll likely work fine when everybody's a good actor and plays by the rules or plays by the subjective narrative of what the intent of everything is. But as soon as you have an adversary who's directly contradicting those or trying to take advantage of that system or hierarchy in order to benefit just themselves or goes against the rules, the question is, how does it stand up in the adversarial situation? And that's really kind of the basis of the libertarian argument, is that, everything will probably work great if there's just great, awesome, nice people in charge who know all the things and can perfectly design all the systems. But what happens when you have ignorant or stupid people or somebody who's evil and controlling and greedy, which inevitably you create a monopolistic controlling institution? Well, those are the people who are going to gravitate to it. So what happens under adversarial conditions? Well, the whole system starts falling apart, and it becomes a feedback loop. The more centralized and greater authority that these institutions or central points of failure have, if they are the central decider of what their level of what their own restrictions are, well, then they're going to just expand those quote-unquote limitations to mean whatever it is that they want to mean, because they're the ultimate arbiter to what their power limits and ability to take money from people is. And we kind of see this same thing. That's the point of these decentralized networks, is to take these trusted third parties out of the recipe of the system and replace it with a distributed network of users, and it's distributing the job over a network of people, and who are arbitrarily picked or just can come and go as they please in the position of the service providing or the third party. So it becomes this open dynamic market where anybody can come and go as they please, and nobody has any protocol-based greater authority than any other. And with proof of work versus proof of stake, there are a couple of dynamics that are really interesting. I've always loved the proof of stake versus proof of work arguments. And you can actually, I think it's episodes 41. Let's see real quick. Yeah, 41 and 42 are Vitalik Buterin's A Proof of Stake Design Philosophy, and then Turtemeester's critique of that article, or essay. And those are both really good, kind of talking about the dynamics of proof of stake versus proof of work. And there's a lot at play there, because the proof of work market itself is, it's not so straightforward as proof of stake. With proof of stake, if you have 60% of the coins, well, then you're the dominant staker, and you essentially have the dominant authority over what gets added to the blockchain and what gets rejected. And on an ongoing basis, you don't have to, as long as you don't sell your coins, you still have 60% of the stake in perpetuity. And nobody can challenge that because of the quote-unquote scarcity of the system. Unless, of course, you have an adversary who decides they want to change the scarcity of the system. Without running a full node in that scenario, you don't really have any say in it. A 60% player can possibly, or at least has an interesting level of control over deciding what those consensus rules are, particularly if there's heavy social decisions over, like delegated proof of stake or something like that in EOS, which is it's been a really huge disaster. But this is not true of proof of stake. Has a pretty wide set of parameters. They're not all the same. And most proof of stake systems, I believe, have essentially a punishment clause, where if you try to put a invalid transaction or invalid block onto the blockchain, any other stakers or full archival nodes, fully validating nodes, will actually reject your block or transaction and then actually punish with a percentage loss of the staked coins. But it's still not straightforward with that, because what if the dominant amount of your market is like clients? Do they follow the dominant proof of stake and the chain that's growing the fastest? So on and so forth. And proof of work is a little bit different, because that market is dynamic. Just because you have 60% of the hash power today doesn't mean you have 60% of the hash power in 3 months. In fact, the market grows so fast that in 3 short months, on many, many occasions, like, you look at that time period and you might have twice the network hash rate. You might have, it might have doubled, tripled, or even quadrupled in that short span of time. It changes very, very quickly, and there are constantly people innovating, finding better sources or lower cost sources of energy, creating higher density chips to compete with yours. So just because you have 60% of the market today does not mean that you keep 60% of the hash power. And pretty much the biggest flaws in that system actually are where you see centralized institutions, like with government regulation and energy costs, where the government is the ultimate arbiter in what price you pay for energy. And we've seen that kind of with Bitmain, is they do not play nice. And most of these are allegations and have not really been substantiated, but these things are extremely hard to substantiate. And oddly enough, anybody who's competing with Bitmain always seems to run into these regulatory roadblocks or imbalanced inconveniences, if you will, that Bitmain never seems to have. There was actually an article not too long ago, which might be good to read on the podcast. I might try to find that. I think I saved it somewhere, but it was about the Quebec hydropower. There was a dam that was selling it at extremely low cost, because that's one thing about proof of work, is it has actually been really beneficial to, like, kind of alternative energy and hydropower investments. Because whereas setting up a huge solar plant or a new dam for hydropower, particularly the one that was going on in the Quebec, is they're able to get a return on their investment much faster if they sell their power to mining companies, who can really quick jump in and set up shop when they still have not gotten the infrastructure to get the power out to customers. So let's say it's going to take them 2 years to build out all the power plant, the infrastructure to get to the nearest cities and stuff, and therefore their $10 billion investment has a going to be paid off in 10 years after all this infrastructure, so on and so forth. That means that in the short term, before they can connect to their customers, they might only be selling 5% of the energy they produce, where 95% of it just completely goes to waste. In the scenario with Bitcoin mining, they get to make a return on their investment much, much faster, because miners can jump in and consume that extra 95% of the energy so that they can actually be profitable very quickly while they're building out the infrastructure to get to customers. And then after they finally reach the customers and prices go back up to the normal operating level, well, then those miners can just pick up shop and go to the next, you know, hydroelectric dam or solar power plant, whatever. So whereas it might have been a 10-year turnaround to make a profit, maybe it drops to 5 years, 3 years, because the miners come in and make up that gap. But what do you know? After those agreements were being made and a bunch of miners were coming in, suddenly, when Bitmain started to enter the market, those prices increased, and they added all these new stipulations and regulations about how big your mining farm had to be to get our lower cost energy, and that your price was different if you had over this certain amount. It was like 500 megawatts or something like that. I don't know the specific number. It was, I can't remember it, but that you had to have some certain size of mining farm to get the more efficient pricing. And oddly enough, guess who had it? Bitmain had just enough to reach that barrier. So those centralized, the systems that are subject to the adversarial conditions are still the centralized points of failure in the proof of work, like, broader market that are, you know, not controlled at all by the protocol. That's kind of an interesting dynamic there that's been a little unfortunate, but hopefully it's a short-lived reality. And there's still a whole lot of people entering the market. And again, 3 months, 6 months down the road, things change incredibly fast in the proof of work systems. So, but with proof of stake, again, you don't have that concern. You own 60% of the coins today. You always own 60% of the coins unless you specifically give them or sell them to somebody else. And even worse is some of these ICOs. There's so many of these systems now. Some of these ICOs may literally, they create all these, it's not even a sunk cost. Whereas normally you would say, okay, when a proof of stake system, what's the likelihood of being able to buy up 51% of the coins? Like, it's practically non-existent, right? Well, what if you run an ICO and only sell 40% of the coins? Then there's no sunk cost and you're not manipulating the price, or not manipulating, but having the price go against you in the market as you continue to buy up coins, because you're not buying it up. You're just creating all 100% of coins, selling 40% and keeping 60% for yourself. Another interesting factor is a lot of these proof of stake systems, seem to be selling that, because our greater efficiency, we can have more throughput and a lot more data added to the blockchain. So we have 1,000 transactions per second or whatever it is that they're boasting. And, you know, Sarah talks about that in her article. But that doesn't make the system any more defensible. In fact, less so, because if you've got 60% proof of stake and most of the other people decide they don't even need to stake or have any reason to run a full node because it's incredibly resource intensive and they're not going to make any, their percentage is so low, they're not going to make any stake anyway, well, then they just won't do it. And the dominant staker has even more authority and control over the system. But these are all interesting when it comes to actually breaking the consensus rules and trying to institute or force a change onto the network. But that's why I think Bitcoin is so important and dominant in the concept of decentralization, because it does have, you know, 110,000, 20,000 nodes right now as a defensible measure against majority hash power attacks, where they cannot change the consensus rules. All they do is force themselves off the network, which we saw with SegWit2x. They basically called that bluff and said, all right, you want to change the consensus rules? Go right ahead. All the nodes are not going to follow you. So I think we've seen that demonstrated in practice. But I think I'll stop there. I've ranted pretty long. We will continue to hit this topic as we have in the past. I think it's a really fun discussion, and I hope you guys enjoyed that one. Again, don't forget to follow Sarah Jamie Lewis on both Twitter and check out her page. And follow me on Twitter at TheCryptoEconomy on Medium and Twitter. And, of course, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And I also checked yesterday. It looks like I still don't have any reviews on iTunes. So if you would like to support the show, you can either donate to the Bitcoin address that I have, or you can rate the show on iTunes. That would be, you know, give me a good rating if you like the show. That would be wonderful. It gives that first impression exposure to people who are looking for a good Bitcoin podcast to listen to. So that would be a huge, huge benefit that, you know, might only cost a couple of, you know, 30 seconds of your time. So if you could do that, that would be wonderful. If not, if you want to, you can always buy your hardware wallet. If you've been putting it off or procrastinating like I did for so long, to get your hardware wallet and secure your Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, I highly recommend Trezor. They're the best of the ones that I have purchased and played around with, and it's the one that I go to all the time, and I really love their interface, everything about them. They got a couple features that Ledger Nano and the others don't have. I do have a Nano and I do like it, but Trezor is kind of my go-to, and I've really enjoyed that device and highly, highly recommend it. You can get that through my affiliate link, which will send a couple of dollars to me on the show notes on the actual episode, and I will post it on the Twitter page as well, or the Twitter comments as well. So that will close us out for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast, and I will catch you tomorrow. Take it easy, guys.
We'll be right back.